Hi folks, hope all is well. This is Jim Carroll saying hello and welcome you to the latest Bantercast, the weekly podcast from the team behind the Banter series of talks and events. At Banter, we put on events in spaces and venues of all shapes and sizes, invite a range of interesting people to come along, and they tell stories, talk about their lives, and discuss various topics and themes. We record what happens in the room, and then we podcast the results. On Easter Monday last, we took part in the nationwide Crinan na Cosca event with a series of banters in Dublin Castle. Here's the first one for you now, in the shape of the great GAA novel. We've had reams of factual books on the sports, but apart from the odd reference to togging out for a match, or heading to a training session, or using the parish pitch as a backdrop, Gaelic games rarely turn up in fiction. It's a rum one, especially given the place which games have in our national culture. Here, our senior hurdle panel of Michael Moynihan from the Irish Examiner, writer Emer Ryan, novelist and Morning Ireland presenter Rachel English, and chief sports writer with the Daily Star, Kieran Cunningham, consider why this is so, and dream up just what the great GAA novel might read like. Hi folks, welcome along to Banter here at Crinan na Cosca at Dublin Castle. My name is Jim Carroll. Thanks very much for giving up your bank holiday Monday morning to come along here. This is the first of four panels we have here today. It's about the great GAA novel, and we've gathered a great senior hurdle and senior camogie panel here with us today to discuss this topic. Starting at the very end, we have Michael Moynihan. Michael is representing the County of Cork today. He writes on sports for the Irish Examiner. He's also the author of Blood Brothers and also the author of a great book called GAA Economics. He's also a ghostwriter for various people. Do you want to kind of tell us who you ghostwrote for? Tomás O'Shea, Ken McGrath,
Dan Shanahan.
And Sean O'Gallagher. Next to Michael, we have Emer Ryan, representing the great county of Tipperary. She's a writer, co-editor of the Banshee Literary Journal, and contributor to Winter Papers and many other journals as well. Welcome along. Next to Emer, we have Rachel English, representing Clare, and she's the presenter of Morning Ireland. She's also the author of three novels, Liz, which The American Girl has just been published. Were you tempted to put a camogie scene into The American Girl?
No, and I did have a couple of hurling scenes, actually, in the first book. The problem is getting people from outside the GAA world to understand what's going on, but we can come back to that.
Excellent. And last but not least, we have Kieran Cunningham representing Donegal. He's a chief sports writer with the Irish Daily Star. Please give him all a round of applause. I suppose let's start with that point that Rachel just made there, about the fact that we look at kind of like fiction, and Irish fiction in particular, and I've been kind of like, I've spent the last couple of weeks diving into various research papers and trying to find out, like, where is the GAA in Irish fiction? Everyone keeps referencing John McGarren and the Barracks. There's a county final scene in that. You talked about Kieran as well. You mentioned it online. Everyone keeps talking about Donny Ryan from Tipperary and the fact that he's going to write the great GAA novel, No Pressure There, Donny, and leaving it with him. And, like, that's it. Like, is that it? Has any of you found any other references to GAA in terms of Irish fiction?
There is a great reference in an English novel by Tim Lott, in which he says the protagonist is going to watch, I think it's Wexford and Galway, and he's anticipating a huge Donnybrook at the game, but it just comes in out of nowhere in his novel, White City Blue, and vanishes again. There's no great explanation for it, etc. So it's funny that there's probably as much, as many citations in English novels as there are in Irish novels for the GAA.
Yeah. Funny thing is, because there aren't that many references around, but the two great works of Irish literature in the 20th century, Ulysses and Waiting for Godot, both have GAA references. That Michael Cusack in the Cyclops episode, the Citizen is based on Michael Cusack, one of the founders of the GAA. And in Lucky's speech in Waiting for Godot, there's a reference to camogie. But actually, if you go through, there's actually quite a few references in Irish poetry to the GAA, but very few novels, some in short stories, some in plays. But I don't know why the novels haven't... No Irish novelist has confronted it to the same extent.
But it's interesting because, I mean, if you look at kind of the worlds of film and TV, and you were talking about this, like me and Emer beforehand, you know, we were discussing the fact that, like, there's very few references as well in kind of like mean film and TV to it.
Yeah, I think film is maybe more suited as a medium to kind of implement the GAA because it's such a visual game, and I think trying to describe it in prose, I don't think it translates into prose very well, actually, you know, because it's so fast. It's so instinctual, it's so chaotic, you know. And I think a writer's instinct is always to get into the mindset of the player and what's this player thinking as he stands over the ball, you know? And I think Seamus Gallagher or Joe Canning or whoever is standing over, he's not really thinking about it at all, I would say, you know? Like, he's just very calm and very blank and just focused, you know? So, I don't know, I think you could write the great... Can you write the great GAA novel is my question. Like, is...
Yeah.
Would it be an entertaining read, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's a huge challenge, like...
Yeah, because we like let's just kind of stick, I suppose, with kind of like the film and TV stuff, you know. And you mentioned early on there's a kind of a Jason Statham film, which Hurley has mentioned yeah. at the start. There's a film, there's a TV series Heroes. The second season begins in a hay barn in Cork, and there's talk about hurling. John Ford like had references to hurling in two of his films, and there's a bizarre film. Have you ever heard of any of you heard of a film called Rooney?
Yeah.
Rooney is just the bizarrest film. It's about a Dublin dustbin man called Rooney who has an ambition to play a hurling in Croke Park, and it opens with the All Ireland 1957, I think it was, Waterford and Kilkenny, and the actor who was acting as kind of Rooney is a guy called John Gregson, and he's they opens on Croke Park. You've got the two teams parading around the park, and John Gregson is part of the Waterford team. Yes. Like, I'm trying to imagine how that would happen today. That how the GAA would feel if someone was shooting a film. They said George Clooney is going to march around Croke Park with the Tipperary or Kilkenny team. You know, yeah. But like it's funny. You know, do you find it strange that there isn't more sort? There hasn't been much more kind of made of it.
Yeah, did you mention Fergus Ty's Clash of the Ash?
Yeah,
you did mention that. Fergus, yeah,
that was wonderful. Yeah, I remember that, and maybe it was one of those rare moments when you saw something and you thought, "Gosh, it didn't even occur to me that you could make a film about hurling, because films are about Hollywood subjects. They're not about guys who want to get onto a hurling team." And obviously, in the case of Clash of the Ash, that his life and the lives of everybody in the area. I was wondering in thinking about this if. Part of it is, it's funny, many of the examples that have been mentioned are, I mean, not very old, but quite old, and there has been relatively little written if you go through, say, certainly the 70s, 80s, 90s. And I wonder if part of that maybe was a bit of sniffiness on the part of some people who write, in the sense that if you go back to the 80s, certainly, I mean, I remember when I first moved to Dublin as a student, I come from Shannon in Clare, and it wasn't as though I ever really thought about the GAA, it was just a thing. It yeah. was, you know, everybody followed the local club, everybody followed the county, and I never really thought of it in terms of identity or anything. And then when I came to Dublin, and you would find more sniffiness about the GAA, now that's totally gone now, in the sense that everything has changed in Dublin. But you know when you used to hear all those references to bog ball and stick fighting and all of that? And I wonder if, you know, there were people who felt, well, I might like to include the GAA in my book, but people will think I'm a bit, you know, I'm a bit not really with the scene here. What I should be writing about is a fella who's doing a load of drugs and goes to London. I shouldn't be writing about his friend who wants to play at midfield for the senior team.
Yeah. Because I often wondered, Jim, if part of the popularity of the Saw Doctors in the early 90s was down to GAA references, because musically they were nothing special. And they did make a lot of references to life in rural Ireland that people got, but I think it was particularly people were engaged by that they would reference Willie Joe Padden or Galway Will Galway Beat Mayo, or people going to minor trials, which I'd never heard in music. And even you go back, you know, you mentioned film, you mentioned television, trusting memory, but like the Reardons was set in a mythical, fictional Kilkenny village. I don't know if hurling was ever mentioned, which is very odd. but just on a film, like last year or the year before, Keith Duggan spoke with Jim McGuinness, Until Victory Always. There were stories going around that the film rights had been bought up. And then people were saying that Michael Fassbender is going to play Jim McGuinness. And you thought, somebody's flying a kite. But Kirsten Sheridan is actually writing the screenplay, because I was talking to a few of the Donegal players who've retired, who played under Jim, and they were saying that she's rung them up and asked them about stories that are in the book and what happened there and what would they think at the time. And she's actually got a development grant, so it might happen, which is very interesting if it does happen. So,
wow.
That would go.
That's metal. I want to kind of go back to some of the rage you said there about kind of like the sniffiness. You know, Emer, when you had that essay in kind of like in Winter Papers last year, you're a writer, you're doing the band, you co-edit kind of Banshee, you've kind of contributed a piece to various journals. What was people's reaction to you kind of like talking about that other side of your life as a kind of camogie player?
The reaction was wonderful, but I was terrified about putting it out there for reasons that Rachel was suggesting, because I feel like my my writing life and like the parts of the literary world that I'd be in and my GA life are like, there's no overlap there, you know, like, but I've kind of found, like, since writing the essay that it's been surprising how many writers have come out of the woodwork and just been like, yeah, I love GA, or I played up until under 21 or whatever, you know, and but it's not something that people really talk about. It's true in, like, book circles or writing circles, you know. Yeah, it's a strange one.
Mm. Do you find, Michael, when you work on research and say GA economics, you know, that book's about where the money is in the GAA. Mm. Like, and it also kind of, we talked about this at Bantra at Our Voice a couple of years ago, and like, it kind of struck me that like your book covered an area in which the GAA was starting to become hip again. I'm not just asking you this question because you're wearing a hipster beard, but like, you know, the fact that like, you know, suddenly the GAA is hip, and what Rachel is talking about there, does that doesn't necessarily apply anymore?
It doesn't. I mean, I'll forgive that crack. I remember when Rachel's novel came out, Ring Her for a Chat, and she actually made a point, which to me kind of sums it all up. She said there was a character in the first book who was from Thurles, who was a teenager, and the way Rachel said, well, naturally, I thought he would be interested in hurling. And I think there is certainly a stratum of literary types to whom that would be a completely alien thought, that they would know naturally or presume naturally that someone from a certain age group, from a certain place in Ireland would have an interest in a particular sport. And I think that's not a problem, not an issue. I think it's just a fact of life that it is an alien learned behaviour to a lot of people, and possibly because on aesthetic grounds that they're more interested in 18th century German poetry, and each to his own. But just when you're talking about what's hip, it's funny that a recurring theme I see in kind of book reviews and so on and so forth is that, oh, you know, a world amazingly imagined, or, you know, puts you into a context that you would never anticipate. And yet, as we've kind of touched on there, there seems to be a reluctance from great, you know, imaginative writers in Ireland to put themselves imaginatively into something that's common probably to 500,000 people, which I find really surprising.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I was wondering, though, if there's also a problem as well in, and this is, you know, rather grubbier in a way, is it to do with the concern that, well, if I write about the GAA, or if I set a book predominantly around a GAA club, which would be a brilliant setting for a book, is anybody going to want it? Is an agent or an editor going to say, well, God, that's great, but you're nobody outside your village would understand that. And I really, really like it, but I haven't a clue what you're going on about. Is it a bit like, you know, if you're writing and you have to be very careful sometimes, say, even in the case of the Gardaí, nobody outside Ireland understands that, so you have to make it clear early on that you're talking about the police. Or Irish names, you know, like, you end up feeling a bit like that, you know, the Saoirse Ronan sketch with Stephen Colbert where he's holding up the names and he's saying, what's this? And she's going, Tyke, and the audience going, oh, that's hilarious, that can't possibly be Tyke. Is there an element of that, that people are scared, well, if I write this, I'm going to put my life and soul into it, and then nobody outside my immediate family is going to read it?
Yeah,
that's a very good point. You know, also kind of reminds me of that the book written by the Irish writer, Jules Fawn Neill. Wasn't that set with a kind of a cricket team in New York.
Yeah, expat cricket in New York. Yeah, that was a hard sell to a publisher.
Actually, Jim, just one good point. I remember talking to a publisher about what I thought was a really, really good idea, a fantastic idea, and he said to me, reduced me to rubble, of course, in 10 seconds. He said, that's a fantastic idea. He said, I bet every sports writer you know would buy that. And I said, yeah. Well, he said, I can tell you that's not a business plan.
Yeah.
to just sell books to sports writers, he said, you won't make money. Like, unfortunately, there is, you know, publishing economics. And the funny thing is, I actually think a GAA novel of some description would probably sell really well, just out of curiosity.
Yeah.
Mm. But the other side of it, I remember a friend of mine saying about GAA economics, said, I know a lot of people who'd really be interested in reading that, but they don't read books, and there's no mechanism to tell them that there's a book that would specifically fit their interests. And I think that's the other push-pull, that even though there is an audience, it's kind of conveying to people, you know, here's a book. And there is that great book by Christy O'Connor, The Club, which is about a club and which actually transcends GAA, because it's just about people in any joint venture.
Yeah.
But I know loads of people who would live and breathe that book, but in a million years they would never read a review of that book to send them out to buy it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's funny, that makes me think as well of Christy O'Connor's other book about the hurling goalkeepers. Yeah. Like, you would never imagine, think, goalkeepers, God, what is there to be said about goalkeepers? And then and it's such a fascinating book.
Yeah. And actually, the publisher who said no to me admitted that he passed on Christie's book, so he said, you might be right. He said, I don't always get it right either.
In your essay in Winter Papers, you mentioned that you were writing a Camogie novel when you were 17, and you revisited a few years later. Why did you abandon it?
Oh, it's just really terrible. For me, looking back on it, it's kind of interesting because it's basically like a thinly veiled diary, essentially. Yeah. You know, main character going through a lot of things I was going through at the time, but, you know, had better hair, snappier comebacks, like, you know, scored a lot more goals and points than I did. But at the time, it was almost like a coping mechanism because I was doing my Leaving Cert. I was had my first year on the TIP Camogie panel, and I was just dealing with a lot of things, and it was like almost like an outlet just to kind of process all this stuff. But I did revisit it for the essay. I had an idea that I might extract parts of it and scatter it throughout the essay. But it was just too bad to include it. Like, I wasn't even so bad it was funny, it was just bad.
So I came across an interview with Tom McIntyre, the playwright, in the Anglo Cell paper when I was just reading up for this panel. And he wrote a play called The Gallant John Joe, which was based partly based on John Joe Riley, one of the great Cavan players, late 40s, early 50s. But he actually played for Cavan himself in goals, Tom McIntyre, and he won a junior All-Ireland. He played for senior for a while. But one of his quotes was very interesting. He thought that playing football was actually a hindrance to being a writer. And there's a great quote in the interview. He said, playing football in Cavan was what they call in our business, taking refuge in the collective. Everybody loves you. You're with the crowd. You're in the populated side of the street, where the demand for the right of the artist is to be the deserted side of the street, clear of the collective. You have a far better view of what's going on. You're not marching with a multitude. Is it lonesome? It's lonesome at the start, but there are attendant joys. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. And I think there is that perception with a lot of people in the literary world that it's completely separate from, like, GA is completely, that's not something we would really touch. There's a gulf there.
There's also a point as well, coming on, following off what Kieran made there, is that GA is a team sport, whereas writing is very much kind of like, as you just described there, McIntyre, and you'd know this as well, Emer and Rachel, it's very much a solitary pursuit, you know? You haven't got, like, 14 people, you haven't got Davey Fitz or Sherlock Nance shouting at you at the same time, you have a publisher and editor, but it's a solitary pursuit.
And a lot of the best sporting novels or films are about individual sports, like especially boxing, rather than team sports, I think.
Yeah. And so many novels about small town Ireland are about the protagonists are people who don't feel comfortable in that setting and who are outsiders and, you know, who...
Yeah, they're not the popular guy on the GAA team.
Whereas if you're on a team, like, you're part of the fabric of the community, you know, it's a huge sense of belonging, and maybe there just isn't that much dramatic tension in that position, you know?
Like, but in your essay as well, you wrote about what Camogie and writing have in common. So they do have some things in common.
I don't know. The essay was like, it was the first time I kind of put on paper my feelings about the GAA, and it was surprising actually, that
there were some links.
Absolutely.
Because it's not as if the GAA doesn't have great characters to kind of, like, mean rip off, you know? I mean, if we tried to put what happened yesterday in Nolan Park onto paper, you know, like, you know, Davey Fitz running onto the pitch, shouldering a few Tipperary lads, grabbing another guy by the helmet, and not being sent off, you wouldn't believe it in fiction, you know? And I'm reminded of kind of what you said there as well, like, about Chrissy Sheridan working on the book on kind of, like, mean Jim McGuinness, Kieran, because it's like, you know, the stories about Jim McGuinness are rife, but the ones we know about and the ones we all know about, we haven't been written about, you know? Yeah. Like, I mean, like, if she wants to know some great stories about Jim McGuinness as a techno fan down the Horns in Tralee, she can give me a call. But, like, there's all these great characters in the GAA that, like, you know, I'm always kind of going, like, is it a case of this is what we want to read about? In that case, we just go and buy their kind of their biography or their ghostwritten biography, as the case may be. Or is it a case that, like, you know, that we need to look at almost like the nuances of what the GAA is about? Because, for example, one of my favorite TV series the last couple of years was Friday Night Live, like the Texas football team. I was kind of going, surely there is the stuff of a story, the stuff of a TV series in what happens in a practice pitch in a GAA on any given week.
Yeah, but, like, I think part of, if you look at the things that have worked very well, and I think why Kirsten Sheridan was attracted to Jim McGuinness' story, it's not so much the sporting aspect, I think that's part of it, but it's a human story, because of the loss of his two brothers and the way that impacted on him and shaped his personality. And that goes, Friday Night Lights is similar, like, it's not just about American football or college team, It's about the people, you know, what the people go through. And I think that's, like, I think if you wrote a book and it was just about detail and training sessions and matches, it would be a very dull novel. Like, it's about the... I think Gerald Nan taught you, Rachel, didn't he?
He did.
But I've been ghosting Ger for years, and like you couldn't write a fictional character like Ger because people say it was completely implausible.
Well, the thing about Ger, then, as you know, is, and why he would be a wonderful character in a book is, and you know, I first met him when I was about 10, and I was in his class at primary school. Is there are so many dimensions to him. Like, he would have a huge interest in writing and in journalism, because I know even at that age, I was kind of, you know, I was the child who read the newspaper and listened to the radio and that. And Ger would have been all on for encouraging this. Yeah. You know, he's a very interesting individual. Like, he is. You know, it's almost a cliche to say he's a complicated person, but he is. And that's what a character like him, and obviously the other Claire man who you were talking about a few minutes ago. I mean, where else would you find Davy?
Yeah.
Is it a question maybe of taking an existing character and fictionalising them in a novel? Or, you know, do for Davy Fitz what David Peace did for Brian Clough, you know, like just the great manager novel, you know? And just draw from real life, like David Peace did with the Damned United, you know.
Mm. Go back to what you said earlier, Michael, about that. Like, you know, I'm curious what you said there about the audience of these books. You know, I mean, the fact is they don't know these books exist, and like, there's loads of people who want to read GA economics, but they don't realise they exist. Do you think, you know, it's a case of that if there was a kind of like a great GEA novel, that, and if it was marketed right, and if it was kind of like sold right, that there would be an audience out there, both here and elsewhere?
Yeah, and you're right about the gap in people's lives who don't own a copy of GA Economics, obviously.
yeah, I mean, look,
marketing and making something known to people is obviously an issue all the time. One thing that's interesting, though, from what you said about Friday Night Lights, is that American template is often held up. I often have people saying to me, you know, why can't there be books about hurling the way there are novels about baseball and this kind of stuff? And it's kind of always interesting to me that a lot of these big American writers have a baseball novel somewhere in their back catalogue, almost as a kind of a rite of passage. But what's also interesting, to tie into what you were saying, is that even with these top-flight intellectuals in America, like an interest in baseball or an interest in American sport is a given. Like, nobody's embarrassed because they know the batting average of this guy or they know how the basketball game went last night. It's funny because you don't get that here. I don't want to name names, but, you know, if some public intellectuals in Ireland had a really strong opinion on the sweeper system in hurling, it would really shock you, you know, whereas, you know, kind of Philip Roth will talk about the New York Yankees or something and no one bats an eyelid, really.
That just reminds me, there's a great story in Brendan O'Hara's book, Over the Bar, which actually it should be in print. I don't know how the GA don't ensure it stays in print. It's one of the best books you can read about the GA. But one of the things, like Samuel Beckett had a sporting background. He was a brilliant cricketer. He's the only Nobel Prize winner for literature mentioned in Wisden's The Cricket Bible. But once Brendan Behan went to, according to Brendan O'Hare's book, Brendan Behan paid him a visit in Paris, and they went for a walk along the banks of the Seine. And a priest from the Irish College recognized Behan and went up to talk to them. And he said, tell me, Mr. Beckett, you know, do you ever go back to Dublin much? And he said, very rarely. And he said, well... Oh, I said, you don't go back. Well, I have been invited back in September. He said, oh, yeah, September, what part? I think it's the middle of the month. Not so bad. You'll miss the hurling, but you'll be there for the football.
There is, just picking up on what Michael was saying, and maybe it goes back to something we mentioned earlier about undoubtedly, and again, this is less so now, and probably because of a lot of changing attitudes in Dublin, but there was a perception, certainly for a long time, that to follow the GAA was almost to be part of an Ireland that was a bit backwards. Yeah. A bit that, you know, and all the
going
jokes...
Going home for the weekend.
Of the jokes. And affectionate as a lot of them are about hang sandwiches and the boot of the car and the flask of tea and tying up refs and putting them in the boot and all of that. Affectionate as a lot of the stuff was, there was an edge to of it too.
Yep. Yeah.
And to be seen to be part of that world and to be seen to be enthusiastic for that. And maybe as well, to some extent, during the 70s and 80s, it also tied up with attitudes towards nationalism, towards what was happening in the north, that it was part of a bigger picture and that people walked away and they didn't want to be seen to be part of that world.
Yeah.
Because I think it's one of the most interesting parts of the current Dublin football team, that because of the way the GAA has changed in Dublin, like it was a kind of a working class, lower middle class sport. And now you have somebody was saying at one stage there were more Blackrock College ex-pupils on the Dublin team than on the Leinster rugby team at one stage. And like, I can't think of anything else, any other place in Dublin, that you've somebody from Ballymun who's beside somebody from Dalkey. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't mix in a workplace, but it's happened in the Dublin full back line.
Yeah, that's really good, because
lurking behind it all, as you can see, is the great unspoken Irish preoccupation with class.
Yeah.
Which is really, you know, which kind of comes behind everything and informs everything. And the GAA is part of that. But as Kieran has said, the GAA now is a slippery customer when it comes to class, because what a typical GAA person is in Cork or Tipperary or Galway may not be like the member of Coola, you know, who's from Dalkey, and you know, you have a notion of what that is and so on. But it's funny that, you know, that class informs so much of our perception in sport as much as everything else, and yet typically Irish, no one actually comes out and says it really, you know, straight out.
Yeah, I think maybe that's why people were a bit fascinated by Coola. I was in Croke Park on St. Patrick's Day to cheer on the other team, Ballyhea, the neighbours. Poor old Ballyhea, there's only about 300 people in the village. They needed a few people there to cheer them on. And there was a guy sitting near us drinking a can of gin and tonic. And I thought, gosh, you'd never see that on a sample stage.
it's like the man at halftime in a Munster final on the terrace, asking how the tennis was going with the game.
But this is a generational change as well, lads, because, you know, as you're talking there, and like me, and as you're talking about, like me, the great intellects, and they have a kind of a regard for the GAA, they don't talk about it. Rich is talking about, like me, the fact that, like, when you came to the 70s and 80s, the GAA was regarded as the other, you know. Dave McWilliams had an interesting column a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about Coola, and he was kind of saying, like me, this is the revenge of the fairest slack wearing Gwilgor, who's kind of like moved off in the country, started teaching in South County Dublin, and basically turned the kids on to kind of, I mean, hurling, and basically out of that you kind of got like Coola. So it's a generational change, because I mean, as we're kind of talking there, you're talking about people talking on the terraces about tennis and about, like, mean GAA as well. I know, as a music fan, you know, I mean, growing up, the GAA and alternative music never met. But right now, it's like, I mean, all my mates who are into, like, I mean, alternative music are into GAA as well. And, like, it strikes me that, like, we're seeing a kind of generational change. So almost to bring it back to the kind of, like, the theme of the panel, you know, does this kind of, like, is that swing going to kind of continue into fiction writing as well?
Yeah, but possibly. And just as a quick digression, the last time Kilkenny won the All-Ireland, they played straight after over the PA wasn't the Rosamund Coyne, but was the Cure's Love Cats, which you wouldn't have heard a few years ago. So.
Won't be heard for a while more.
Yeah.
Sorry, that reminds me very briefly, and again, this is a digression of going to see something actually that Jim has written about a few years ago, Bruce Springsteen, in this case in the RDS, and Aim and my husband remarking that it looked like very much like a crowd going to a GAA match. And honestly, not a beat passed before the guy in front of us turned to the fellow beside him and said, do you think Tip can carry the league form on into the championship?
And Brian Cody's a big fan, apparently. He goes to him all the time.
I stood behind him a few years ago in the RDS. It was lashing rain, and there was nothing but young lads going up to get selfies with Brian Cody. They'd no interest in the music.
The real boss.
Once the word spread that Brian Cody, and there was a qualifier on that very night. I think it was Galway versus Clare, and Kilkenny were due to meet the winners of the qualifier in the next round. And I remember everybody saying, geez, Brian, you're fierce relaxed about who you'll be meeting in the next round if you're here tonight rather than watching Galway versus Clare.
Even at Electric Picnic and everything, because it's first Sunday in September, there'll always be a tent with a big screen for the hurling final, and it's always jam-packed.
Yeah. And that's something as well, Electric Picnic kind of promoters. It's really interesting. Again, that class thing that you mentioned earlier on, Michael, over the years they've tried to kind of get away from that. When John Mills was the promoter, he never would allow kind of the matches to be screened because he kind of felt like taking away from the music. But he's from Longford, so none of you, like, he's never featured in an All-Ireland hurling final. But it's been continued on, and like it used to be, I remember there was one year, it was a year at Tipperary, but okay, 2010, the only place you could see the game on in the whole kind of our arena was the pub in the Gaeilge tent. So basically, it was the TG4 broadcast of it. So you had all these people kind of like just crowding in and kind of learning their Irish, like relearning about Cruinniu. They were just kind of relearning it again, you know?
I didn't realise, by the way, this whole panel was assembled purely so you could talk about Tipperary reassembling
the throne. It's another underlying theme, Mark. You know this. But getting back to, I suppose, where we came in, there's probably people in the audience with notebooks kind of wondering, okay, so what is the great GAA novel going to look like? Because we talked an awful lot about what it mightn't look like. So, like, I mean, we've kind of skirted around kind of, like, I mean, ideas about, like, locations. We talked about why, a lot of why it hasn't happened. So if it was to happen, where do you, like, I mean, especially there's two novelists on the panel, you know, Where would it go? Where could you imagine it going? That's open to all four of you.
It's an easy question.
Well, somebody else, please.
Well, obviously, I think actually what Rach said, something about a club. It's interesting that Kieran mentioned Over the Bar, which is the greatest GAA book, because it's actually not about matches or players. It's about something a bit amorphous, the kind of culture of the GAA and stuff that you only understand if you're kind of steeped in the GAA. And to me, a great GAA novel would be something set in a village or a town where the GAA is kind of slightly off to the side, but yet informing everything. It's kind of, you know, I actually think if you're in the dressing room or if you're following a player or something, it could get, you're going to drift into those ghost-written cliches, yeah, because you'll filter everything through that. Whereas I think if it's something like, you know, the closure of a factory in a village and everyone is kind of Friday night lights, everyone's dependent on the junior team getting to the county final, where it's slightly off to the side. I think that would be a great GAA book. In the way, you know, the John McGahern, it's not front and centre, but if you know the GAA, you can pick up on the markers and the cues in that as well. Mm-hmm. So I actually think the great GAA novel will be slightly to one side of the GAA itself.
And I think there's a hint in those McGahern stories of where you have to go as well, that there's no sentiment in them. And there was, for years, in GAA journalism, it was very sentimental. And, you know, like, is it Eddie Mack, where he writes about the retired midfielder and how he struggles to cope with his fame is gone, and, you know, he's a nobody now. And, like, that's a lot of, you know, we all know players like that, that once the cheering stops, they find it very hard. But, you know, we do see that. Like, if you see the run-up to the All-Ireland Club Finals, there's a temptation that it's, you know, a band of brothers, a band of sisters, a band of brothers and sisters, and that everybody's together. But anybody that knows clubs, like, they're often a nest of vipers, to be honest. There's a lot of backbit. You know, I'd say that, you know, even when they won an All-Ireland club, I'm sure there's an ex-manager going to the back and grumbling about it. Like, and that's the reality. You have to show the reality rather than the sentimental, sugar-coated version of it.
Yeah.
And there would also have to be people as well who don't feel part of it, who feel disconnected from it, who don't think that it's for them, who see themselves as standing outside that, because, you know, the old thing, if there's no conflict, there's no novel. So, yeah, those people would definitely have to be there too. Yeah. The man who wants to sell the land or something.
Yeah. Eimear, in your essay, I think at the start you said you thought it was impossible to write it, a GAA novel.
I think so, yeah, and... Partly because I have an abandoned Camogie novel in my drawer, but even simple things like, if you're writing a novel, how many characters do you want to have, you know?
Yeah.
You're talking about five, maybe, really strong, finely drawn characters. If you have someone who's playing on a team, first of all, you have to have 15 characters straight away. Maybe two or three would be the important ones, but, like, they all have to be developed in some way. Like, it's strange, like, in one sense, like, it's a great setup. There's so much opportunity for conflict.
Yeah.
This mix of people thrown together. But then you have to create every one of those, and it just becomes too crowded, I think, you know?
Yeah, and every one of them has to have a family or some hinterland or children or a partner or some conflict at work or whatever. And it's true, you could end up with an awful lot of characters.
Yeah, and you don't want any player to end up just being a name and the reader's kind of going, oh, who's this person again? And
is that the same Pat that we referred to 25 pages back?
Exactly, yeah.
Apparently, no, I think it was a reply to you on Twitter this morning, Rachel. Somebody was saying there are kids' novels. I didn't realise that now. There are quite a few.
Neither did I. Yeah. And Sarah Webb was pointing
out,
who's a children's writer and who works a lot with children books, was pointing out that there are several children's books based around GAA teams, which I hadn't known. And somebody else then popped in and pointed out that there's actually a GAA science fiction novel.
I didn't follow that. The GAA science fiction novel.
Inevitably, it's based in Tipperary.
It's called the last senior match in Tipperary,
yeah,
or something
like that.
Yeah,
there's a hurling wasteland in Tipperary, or I can't remember. I read the title. Yeah.
Anyway, it's,
I've never heard of it.
It should be easy to find. It's out there. I Googled it and found it in the first search. Up it came. There are plenty of references to it out there.
I'm going to buy that. So, minute I finish here, I'm going to buy that and read it for next panel. But getting back to what you just said there, like, I mean, Eimear, but like, I mean, the fact that, like, you think it's kind of impossible, you know, it... But like, I'm kind of curious, because it's like, if it's something that kind of is of relevance to so many people, doesn't it stand to reason that somewhere down the line someone's going to crack it? Someone's going to crack that kind of like that code.
I think so, yeah. And it's seeping in slowly. Myself and Michael were chatting recently about Louise O'Neill's Asking for It, which it kind of forms part of the context in the background of that novel.
Yeah. Because the popular lads are GAA players.
Yes. Yeah.
And there's plenty of references to someone turning up. Isn't there somebody who turns up at the prize giving or something, the annual club prize giving in the state of her, and you know, look at that dress and all that.
Exactly,
that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a book that's sold all over the world.
Yeah. And it nails the culture of it really well, because the main character, like the young lads who are kind of getting called up to the Cork senior team or whatever, they're rock stars in their local small community, you know, and that's very true to life, I think. And even the main character, she's not that into football herself, she's kind of bored by it, but she knows it's socially desirable to be with the footballers, you know, like that. And it just kind of shows the iconic status that they have in a community, you know.
And it shows too that, you know, a novel about the GAA needn't necessarily be a celebration of the GAA. I mean, there's plenty of ugly aspects to
the dark
it
ways,
that you,
yeah.
you know, that you could certainly. And that's a perfect example. Even though, you know, it's not like, well, you would hope that it's not endemic to GAA culture that kind of stuff would happen. But you know that it's a superstructure for another kind of book, which isn't necessarily a celebration of the GAA itself.
Yeah, and I think it is. There is a generational shift within the GAA, and it will be in writing that. It's not going to be a Sebastian Barry or John Banville that's going to write it. It might be a Kevin Barry or Donal Ryan or an Eimear or Louise O'Neill. Like, it's going to be a different generation coming up. I think it's pretty clear that the likes of Roddy Doyle would have been of the view that you mentioned many in the 80s. Like, they would have no time for GAA, and I don't think Banville is going to be writing about the Wexford Renaissance.
You never know.
I don't think he was there yesterday taking notes on David's behaviour.
Even though he was chief sub in the Irish press for years, which would be very much GAA paper, but it didn't seep through to him.
Going to some of the both Kieran and kind of Michael mentioned in passing, and this kind of would be the last kind of question. You know, you've mentioned GAA a couple of times, and like, you know, there's the GAA culture that we all know from the clubs and from the counties. There's also the GAA kind of superstructure which sits up in kind of like Mean Jones's Road there, you know, and like that's still a bastion of conservatism in such a way that kind of like people are almost like, if they're going to write a work of fiction around the GAA, they would have to kind of react some way against that.
But there's a kind of, there'd be ample room for a kind of House of Cards. You know, there was a great line years ago when Bertie Ahern was trying to build the Bertie Bowl, and he came up against sports politics, and somebody said, you know, a politician meets real politics, as in sports politics, and how savage that is. So, I mean, there's obviously a great kind of comic novel, a kind of a Decline and Fall of a Scoop, be written about GAA officialdom.
The Garth Brooks debacle, you know.
Well, there you go. And there's ample, you know, kind of, we'll have to send that back to Watermark, isn't in Irish, on the, you know, on the appeal. The appeals mechanism itself, sure, Samuel Beckett would have had plenty of fun.
It'd be interesting if any player ever tried it. Like, Paul Gavin wrote his own autobiography, and he writes his own column in the Sunday Times, that whether a player who has... who does like writing, ever tried to do something like that down the road. Like, you talk to somebody like Jamie Clark in Armagh, he's incredibly well read. And I suspect he writes, you know, where he takes that would be interesting.
That'd be fascinating to see.
Yeah.
I mean, who would you like to see? Last question before we kind of get some questions from the audience. Who would you like to see in that case? Which kind of hurler or current footballer would you like to see to have secret writing smarts and writing skills?
Oh my gosh.
I can name a few off the top of my head, and I would love to never see another line from them in print or on the air, if that makes any sense.
Would your head not be wrecked, though, from all those years of having to speak in player interview speak, you know, as in saying, well, look at now, and away we go. And I'd say, we're not underestimating X here today. We knew we'd be up for a real game and all that. I think you'd need a time to... almost to be decontaminated from all of that. That you actually learnt to speak about the GAA in terms that weren't GAA interview speak. Yeah.
But actually, I remember talking to a guy
actually for one book, not the subject of the book, but after 20 minutes of this, stop, this is going nowhere. And this is an intelligent guy with a third level degree. I said, look, give me something better. He said, I can't. He said, I'm trying, but I can't. And it was literally, it was 50-50. We had great respect for them. They were tough. It was a sunny day. Went to the last minute. I said, stop. And the funny thing was, he just could not break out of that. As soon as the machine turned on, he was great company until the tape recorder was turned on. But as soon as the red light started blinking, just couldn't break out of the cliches at all for love or money. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing about the GAA, even though there are these mad, fantastic characters, like many of them from Clare, but there's also this sense of, there's this obsession with modesty,
It
kind of stems from amateurism, I suppose, and the fact that it's not for you as an individual, it's for the community, it's for the parish, it's for the county, and lads are kind of nearly afraid to be seen to be thinking they're great or something,
Conor McGregor in the GAA. Many people would react to a Conor McGregor type figure in the GAA.
Would he last?
Depends on the cornerback it was marked. But it's funny, when you go back to, I was going back to that Tom McAdoo thing. Tom McAdoo was a goalkeeper. And one of the things he said, writers stand in goal because they want to play and watch. And like Albert Camus was a goalkeeper. And Patrick Kavanagh was a goalkeeper. And one of the best, he wrote one great essay on the GAA called Gut Your Man. And instead of anybody writing an Ulster Football Championship preview any year, it should just be reprinted because it sums up every game involving Tyrone Monaghan or Donegal.
Okay, I think we've got time for kind of any questions from the audience. Any questions, just put your hand up and we'll get them. Yep.
Players aren't paid as such, but we're getting there really. Is the opportunity for the great Irish GAA novel, are we losing that opportunity now? Are we going to sort of professional era?
So will the professional era mean we'll never see a kind of a great GAA novel? Oh, we see kind of great GAA novels brought to you by various brands instead.
Yeah. Well, it is draining a bit of the colour out of it, I think, because players are, like Michael knows, players are media trained.
There's never been a great rugby novel, has there? I suppose you can't best Ross or Carl Kelly.
They're probably worse in the sense that so many of the rugby players now come through the school academy team that they have very little life experience, I would say that.
Yeah.
And that was always the thing in GAA and in rugby, in fairness in the amateur days, that you had a cross section. But I suppose now the problem with GAA players is a lot of them come through school, college, a lot of them seem to come out. They don't have, a lot of them, a huge career drive. They just want something that will facilitate their playing career for a few years. So again, a lot of them don't have that kind of hinterland, if they have personalities beaten out of them by the manager.
Stop being so interesting.
I've caught a manager instructing a player about what to say, and the player actually said, I've been to college, I'm intelligent. I mean, that's in the kind of, obviously, the championship context. I don't want to give anything away, but down the line, I think you suffer because, you see the same heads popping up, say, as pundits all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's because, a lot of them aren't interested in that. They just want to play the games, work, go home, etc. But I would say definitely there is a draining away of the colour.
Yeah, to pick up on the rugby example, I remember reading a book about the famous Munster team that beat the All Blacks, and it's been mythologised over and over again, but it was just fascinating to read that on the morning of that match, Brendan Foley was delivering minerals around Limerick.
Yeah.
I kind of thought, what a story to have. So he did his day job, he delivered trays of red lemonade and Fanta or whatever around the pubs of Limerick, and then he went off and beat the All Blacks. It's not going to happen again.
And you see, last November, they obviously all got up and had a protein shake, and sat in a room with motivational slogans. Know what I mean? But that's what you're missing. It's not, and obviously it's a different era, but just because it's a different era doesn't mean it's not a hell of a lot more interesting, because you have that variety in backgrounds. And you have guys who are doing that and they're doing this. But no, certainly in rugby, it's almost a lost cause because they've all come through the same path and they've all hit the same markers.
There is a pattern now, Michael, I'm sure, noticed as well, that a lot of people now are going to former players for interviews. And it's not just... access is one reason, because they know they're more likely to get them than a current player, but also it's because they have more to say and they're often more interesting. They're just... there's so much paranoia going on if you're within a county setup now. Bar a few exceptions, like Waterford have been very open under Derek McGrath, Waterford hurlers, Monaghan footballers, but virtually everywhere else is closed shops.
Yeah, and then that goes back to what Emer was talking about earlier on, about the modesty factor as well, you know, like players don't want to be, like if someone in the team has been singled out as a star, the other players resent him. I'm sure the other 14 players on the Galway team resent Joe Canning, you know.
Which apparently is why, for years, there was a reticence to publish GA autobiographies. This publisher, who's since retired, said to me, he actually approached players who said, who'd want to read a book about me?
Yeah.
Then that was literally their first... And now you see, with respect, you see some players bring you up books and you'd say...
Who would have the temerity
to write a book about you? You know, but that whole... That has shifted as well, obviously. There's a generational... And it's not as overt as Conor McGregor, but... You know, a lot of guys are far keener on pushing their brand according to them, what they want to push.
And then, in fairness, there are some players who have just genuinely transcended the team and through the kind of the sheer exuberance of their own personality. Players like John Milan, who like every single person in the country knows, even if they're not a big hurling supporter, because he just had that personality that brought him above and beyond and everything. And people would say, well, I just love to watch him because I love his enthusiasm and I love it when he's doing this and he's riling them up. And he does, and he's a lovely pundit on the radio as well, because he's so natural and he's so enthusiastic.
Yeah. Got time for one last question. Yeah, gentlemen here.
I think an interesting
to push it out. But that also kind of lends itself then, going back to what you're talking there about volunteerism and the community, going back to something I think like Kieran said earlier on, and it's been in my mind ever since you said it, and I'm going back to kind of Leestown and the Reardons back in the 70s, 80s, and there was no GAA there. There's no GAA in Bracken or Glenmore either, but that was Wicklow. But like, you know, it's I'm just kind of curious about what the gentleman has just been talking about, like that aspect of community and volunteerism, and that's definitely right for now, isn't it?
Just as he was talking there, it reminded me, when I was growing up, the teenage disco in the town was in the GAA club. It was just known as the Ga. Are you going to the Ga on Friday? Yeah. No, my dad won't let me. And it was like it was a real focal point. Even if you weren't a member of the club or didn't play any of the games, it was a real focal point for every young person in the town. Knew the hall in the Ga, and we used to go, and you know, the fellas had shake the heads to AC/DC, and then the girls would be singing along to Madonna, and it was. I'm not sure if it was what the GAA was founded for, but it was very, very important in our lives.
It's funny. I spoke to Eamon O'Shea for GAA Economics. He made the point that actually a GAA club, with respect to other sports, is one of the few for an Irish society where you have a cross section of people meeting for a common purpose, whether, as he said, it's someone who's very wealthy or someone from, you know, a poorer background, And it's the unity of purpose that kind of draws them together. Certainly, as we were saying earlier, I actually think some kind of play or a Netflix mini-series about about the machinations within the club, good and bad, would be terrific. Because, I mean, if you even look back through the headlines, some of the... We say the clubs which scored very well in the Celtic Tiger and the clubs which were left on the hook for millions would even give you a wider context. But certainly that's a very manageable frame, I think, for any kind of endeavour, the club, because there's a hierarchy and there are events and there's, you know, there's a, as you say, such a cross-section of people who are always kind of pulling together most of the time until the time to elect the chairman and all the knives come out, obviously.
And there can be a lovely kind of snarky humour as well. Like, you know, you hear those exchanges. I remember hearing somebody talking about they saw a member of the famous Clare team from 95 and 97 and he was with his children and the other fellow looked at him and he said, girls, unfortunately. What I'm saying is there's a cruelty and there's a darkness and there's plenty there, you know, there's plenty there in those kind of honest exchanges that could get you thinking.
I think it's definitely a topic we're going to come back to, but right now that's it for us. So thank you very much for coming out this morning. Thanks very much to our panel, to Michael, to Emer, to Rachel and to Kieran. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to Michael, Kieran, Emer and Rachel for joining us at Crinu, and thanks to Zoe, Penny, Rachel and all at Crinu and Dublin Castle for their help with this. This podcast was recorded by Laszlo Volek and the Bantercast series producer is Tanya White. Check out thisisbanter.com for news we're up to at Banter, plus you can also listen back there to all the Banter podcasts to date. We'll be back next week with another podcast. Until then, goodbye and take care.